Margaret Wilburn has been there. Has been there. Joanne Murphy has been there. Mark and Joey McMinn have been there. Edith Allen has been there. And for just a moment in your mind today, I'd like for all of us to go there. Would you open your Bibles to Psalm 56? Psalm 56 and 57 are sister psalms, it seems to me. And so I want us to see the highlight of a common thread that runs through them. And I want us to think about, as we do so, contemplations in a cave. As we think about Psalm 56 and 57, we're going to see three common things that are found in each of these psalms. And as we think about each of these psalms, we're going to see that not only what is the common thread in each of these, they can be found in each of the psalms of David. But as we look at these two psalms in particular, Psalm 56 and Psalm 57, we're going to find that there is a complaint that David lifts up to God. He expresses to God hurt over what's going on in his life. There is a call for God's help, and there is a celebration of His greatness and His deliverance. Now, those three things don't always fall in order, and he jumps back and forth from one to the other. But I think in both of these psalms, you'll see those three things. In fact, you may have observed that in many of the Psalms of David, you see those same three things rearranged, expressed in different words, but basically there's a complaint, a call for help, and either some expression of confidence in God or a celebration of what God has done or what God will do in anticipation of God's deliverance. So join with me just a few moments as we hit just a few highlights of these two Psalms. The contemplations in a cave. First of all, as we look at Psalm 56, you have an introduction in the psalm to the psalm, and many of our Bibles there just under the announcement of the psalm number. It says it's to the choir director, and I think some 32 psalms have that designation. It says it's a miktam, and there are some six or seven psalms with that designation, signifying likely its beauty. There's often in many of the Psalms an according to statement. In other words, it's probably telling us what tune it was sung by. In this case, some tune known as apparently the Dove of the Mountain. But what I want us to focus on is not so much who it was to or what tune it was sung to and so forth. But what I want us to focus on is the situation in David's life. You may recall a few weeks ago we began to looking at what we called situational psalms. Psalms that are connected to some point in the life of David. And as we began this little section, we started in Psalm 59 because it was the first chronologically and began to work ourselves forward. As we look at Psalm 56 and 57, I do believe these two go together. They begin with almost the exact same phrase. They have similar ideas and flow as you go through them. And they describe two events that go back to back. As we look at what's going on in Psalm 56, our little superscript, if you will, our little subtitle, tells us that it is connected to the time that David spent among the Philistines in Gath. And if we go back to 1 Samuel chapter 21, what has happened is David is on the run from Saul. Saul has tried to take his life. He surrounded his home. His wife, Michal, warns him, David's wife, Michal, who is also Saul's daughter, warns him that her father's trying to kill him, and so he flees for his life in the night. He later would go to the city of Nod, the place where Ahimelech, the high priest, is. This would result later in the death of the high priest and 84 other priests. But in the meantime, in that time between the time he visited Nob and Saul killed those priests for him making his visit, the end of 1 Samuel 21 tells us that he went to Gath. And I want you to think about just how far down David has gone. Back in 1 Samuel 16, Samuel goes to David's house, anoints him as king, says, "You're going to be the next king of Israel." In 1 Samuel 17, he's on the top of the world as he defeats the great giant Goliath. But now he is so far down that his only place of refuge is in Philistia. Where was Goliath from? Philistia. What town did he live in Philistia? Gath. People saying of David and Saul, they said, "Saul has killed his thousands. David has killed his tens of thousands." Who were those tens of thousands? Philistines. When he had gone to Nob in the beginning of 1 Samuel 21, he didn't have anything to eat, he didn't have a weapon, and he had no army with him. He is totally by himself. So he gets something to eat from the bread that's on the table of showbread, and he doesn't have a weapon. So Ahimelech says, "The only weapon I've got in the house is a sword." Whose sword was it? It was the sword of Goliath of Gath. And so here is a man who made his reputation killing Philistines. His reputation began by killing the hero of the village of Gath, or the town of Gath, and he shows back up in Gath carrying the sword of their hero, running for his life. Folks, that is just about as far down as you can get. When you're so desperate that you would turn to your mortal enemies as a last place of refuge, thinking they'll not recognize me. But as you think of all the people he's killed, in fact, he had to kill 100 Philistines just to be able to marry the daughter of Saul. Think of all those families impacted. Think of all those soldiers he's faced in battle. It was inevitable that somebody, somewhere, was going to recognize him. And recognize him they did. And so they captured him and they took him before the king of Gath. And David, it says, became afraid. Because they said, "Is this not the king of Judah? Is this not the one they sang songs about? He has killed his tens of thousands." And David became afraid. And David had to make a split-second decision. That's what soldiers have to do in battle. And so he pretended to be mad. He acted like a crazy man. He acted like he was out of his mind. And so the king of Gath finally says, "Listen, I've got enough madmen in my own country. I don't need another one from somewhere else." And so they released David. I want you to think about what he's had to do. He went from being a king. He went from being a victor over Goliath, standing there with Goliath's sword taking off his head, standing in triumph as the armies of Israel shouted. And now he's not only had to go to his enemy, but he's had to degrade and humiliate himself and act like he was mad with saliva running out of his mouth to get free. The great warrior is broken. He has been humbled in the very presence of his enemies. And so it is, out of that grief comes this psalm. "Be gracious to me, O God, for man has trampled upon me. Fighting all day long he oppresses me. My foes have trampled on me all day long, for they are many who fight proudly against me. When I am afraid, I will put my trust in you, in God whose word I praise. In God I have put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can mere man do to me? All day long they distort my words, and all their thoughts are against me for evil. They attack, they lurk, they watch my steps. They have waited to take my life. Because of wickedness, cast them forth. In anger, put down the peoples, O God. You have taken account of my wanderings, Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? Then my enemies will turn back in the day when I call. This I know, that God is for me. In God whose word I praise, and the Lord whose word I praise, in God I have put my trust, and I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me? Your vows are binding upon me, O God. I will render thank offerings to you, for you have delivered my soul from death, indeed my feet from stumbling, so that I may walk before God in the light of the living. Do you hear a man who's just been surrounded by his enemies because he had to run from his own people? Do you hear a man who seems like he feels like he's been hounded at every step over and over? He says, all day long, all day long, all day long. In fact, this episode began because he had to flee in the middle of the night. His enemies not only pursue him in the day, his enemies pursue him in the night. And he's like a wild animal that's being hounded by a pack of hounds. And over he says, they pursue me, they trample me, they seek me, they give me no rest. I want to highlight what he says in verses 8 and following. I want you to think about not what he says, but when and how and where he says it. He says it as he's running from his enemies. He says it as he's still feeling the pressure. The sound of the hounds is still in his ears. He can still hear their breath on his heels. He says in verse 8, "You have taken account of my wanderings. Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book?" I'm reminded of Matthew chapter 10, verses 29 and 30 that says the Lord has numbered the hairs upon our heads. That God knows us in intimate detail. And even as He's on the run, and remember, He's alone. Later He's going to have His mighty men who are going to fight by His side. But now He is completely and absolutely alone. But He says, I'm not alone. Lord, I know You have watched what I've done. I know You are aware of my tears. Now, what you think about it, here is a great warrior who's taken on the most powerful soldiers of his day, reduced to tears. A man who would be king has already been anointed so, but yet has not yet ascended to the throne, who has been reduced to tears. But he says, Lord, keep my tears in Your leather waterproof pouch. Is the term he uses here. There was an interesting custom that we know existed in the Greek and Roman days. We do not know for sure if it existed in the days of David. But in the days of the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, they developed a custom of taking a bottle, and when you went to weep at the death of someone you loved, you would keep some of the tears in a bottle. And they would do one or two things with those tears or that bottle of tears. They would either put it at the tomb of the person who died, kind of like we would put flowers today, or they would keep it in their homes as a reminder of the person and how much they love them. And again, it's fascinating to think of what David says here. Don't know if that custom existed in his day, or did what he say impact that custom developing later. Really have no idea. But what he's saying is, Lord, You notice, You care, You value me. Treasure my tears. Don't ignore them. Don't cast them aside. And he says, are not my wanderings written in Your book? Over and over through the Bible, you have this reference to God's book. And the idea is that God knows those who are His, and God knows here what's going on in the life of David. He's saying, Lord, I know that I'm alone. There's no human beings with me, but I'm convinced I'm not alone. I'm convinced that You're with me, and You notice, and You care. I'm reminded of 2 Kings chapter 20 and verse 5, when Hezekiah was told that he was going to die. And in bitterness and tears, he prayed that God would give him more life. And the message came back to Hezekiah, I have seen your tears. In John 11:35, that quick verse that we probably quoted in class sometime when we were growing up and we needed a memory verse in a hurry, Jesus wept, tells us that not only does He notice our tears, But what we see through the life of Jesus is He shares our tears. Through Jesus, the Father knows how David feels when he is reduced to tears. And one of the beauties of heaven is that in chapter 21 and verse 4 of Revelation, those tears are forever wiped away. And so he noticed his tears, and he put his trust in God. I'm convinced that you noticed my tears, and so I will trust in you. Even in the midst of my despair, I will count on you. I will count on your word. I will count on the covenant that we've made between each other. And I'm convinced that because I put my trust in you, you will turn away my enemies. You will defeat my enemies. I want us to think about what David does. He trusts in God. He believes God notices his tears, and he believes God will give him victory over his enemies, even though as yet he can see no hope or reality. And then there's Psalm 57. In Psalm 57, you have an event that's right after the escape from Gath. If you look at the beginning of 1 Samuel 22, it says, having fled from Gath, that David went to the cave of Adullam. There's two different cave experiences in David's life. One is going to come later. Remember where he's hiding in the cave and Saul comes in and he secretly cuts off the corner of his cloak. That's another cave experience. Because of the similarities between Psalm 57 and Psalm 56, I tend to believe that the cave experience being referred to in Psalm 57 is not the one that would come later when he's hiding in the cave and Saul comes in. It's not the one when he's hiding there with his men. It's the time when he's at the cave of Adullam and he's alone when he enters that cave. So in essence, what he's doing is he's in the cave and he's reflecting on what's just happened at Gath. And he's reflecting on what's just happened at Nob. And he's reflecting on what happened back at Gibeah when Saul plotted against his life in the middle of the night. I want you to think about what it's like when you've been in a terrifying situation and you have that adrenaline rush and whatever you have to do to get out of that situation. But then once you get away from it and you're free and you're safe for a moment and you're by yourself, what happens? Suddenly you feel very tired. Suddenly it's as if all the energy has been drained from your body because you've been running on adrenaline for so long. But now you're alone and it's all run out and you're exhausted and you're scared and odds are you're reduced to tears. That's where David is. He's alone in that cave and he's thinking, I couldn't even hide among my enemies. What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? What is going to happen to me? And so he says, be gracious to me, O God. Be gracious to me. My soul takes refuge in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will take refuge. Until destruction passes by, I will cry to the God Most High, to God who accomplishes all things for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He reproaches him who tramples me, Selah. And God will send forth His loving kindness and His truth. Don't you notice that Selah that's put there at the end of verse 3? That's a pause in the music. He's saying, I want you to stop and think about what I've just said. I want you to notice his emphasis on refuge, and remember, he's in a cave. He's run to hide in a cave for refuge. He has nowhere else to go. He's not safe in the towns. He's not safe in foreign towns. He has nowhere to hide, so he's reduced to hiding in a cave. But what he says in the psalm is, the cave is not my refuge. I'm not hiding in a cave. I'm hiding in my God. God, You are my refuge. This cave cannot defend me. This cave cannot hide me. But You can. You can give me the victory. You can help me overcome. He says in verse 4, my soul is among lions. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire. Even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows and their tongue a sharp sword. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They dug a pit for me. They themselves have fallen into the midst of it. Pause. He presents his problem to the Lord. Lord, I'm surrounded by the lions, and their jaws snap at me. They prepared a net to capture me, a pit for me to fall in, like they would prepare a pit for a wild animal. Lord, I'm overwhelmed. But even in the midst of my problem, I will praise and honor and glorify your name. Even as I look at the pit, even as I try to avoid the snare, even as I hear the growl of the lion, I will praise your name. And I am convinced, Father, that you will cause them to fall in their own pit, just as you hung Haman on the very gallows that he built for Mordecai. That is the kind of faith he had. And then he says, my heart is steadfast, O God, my heart is steadfast. I will sing, yes, I will sing praises. Awake my glory, awake harp and lyre. I awaken the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your loving kindness is great to the heavens and your truth to the clouds. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth. In the midst of that cave, he sang. Father, I adore you, and I lay my life before you. How I love you. Will you sing with me? Father, I adore you, and I lay my life before you. Oh, how I love you. It's easy to sing here. It's easy to sing in the confines of this room where we're comfortable. We've got heat or air when we need it. We've got cushions under us and behind us, and we're surrounded by a host of friends. But faith is found in the song in the cave. When you're alone and you're weeping and you're a king lying on your face in the dust of the earth, that is where real faith is found. And that's where a real God who makes a real difference is found. And in the pit of his cave, David lifted up praise to his God. And he says, I trust in you, even though when I look around, I struggle to see a reason to do so. But I am convinced that you will overwhelm my enemies and that you will give me victory. What does David teach us to do when we're in the cave? What does David teach us to do at those moments in life when we feel surrounded and we hear the growling and the snapping of our enemies? We see the sharpness of their teeth and the drooling from their jaws because they are trying to devour us. It can come in the form of people who want our job. It can come in the form of people who want to destroy our reputation. It can come in the form of illness. It can come in the form of financial hardship. It can come in the form of the loss of loved ones. What is it in your life that has put you in a cave? He says when you're in the cave, he says the first thing you do is you trust God. You trust God when you're in the cave. Don't trust in yourself. Don't necessarily trust at this point in other people. Put your trust in God when you're in the cave. The next thing he tells us to do, you may see on the screen, is to turn to those who are next to you. It's interesting when you look at Psalm 57, that in Psalm 57, there is at the end of that psalm more hope than there has been in most of the psalms. And the reason for that, is because it says while he's in that cave, his family gathers to him. He's not alone anymore. And so what I want to challenge you to do is to turn to those around you. I want you to look to the person to your right and look to the person in your left. We're not perfect. We make mistakes. But if you'll give them half a chance, they'll be there in your cave when you need it. Trust in God. Guys, could you pull up the next screen? Turn to your friends. And then touch somebody else. I find it interesting if you look in 1 Samuel 22 and verse 2. At the end of verse 1, it says, when his family heard he was in the cave, they went to him. Now remember, this is the same family that mocked him. Remember, his brothers made fun of him when he came to the battle at the Valley of Elah when they were facing Goliath. And he said, why doesn't somebody face Goliath? And his older brother just said, oh, you're just curious. You're just a kid. But when the chips are down, who was it that came to the cave? You know, it's kind of one of those old things. I may beat my brother up, but you better not touch him. And when David was in that cave, I'm just kidding, don't go home and beat your brothers up. But when the chips were down, his family came to the cave. But then in verse 2, it says the distressed came to the cave. It says those who were in debt came to the cave. It says those who were disconcerted about what was going on in the country came to the cave. Now, why did all those people come to David? In fact, it says before he left the cave, he had an army of 400. He was alone at Nob without even bread and a weapon. Now he's in that cave with 400 warriors. Now, why did those people come to David? Because David understood them. The people who were distressed knew David understood them. The people in debt knew David understood them. Once you've been through a cave, you have a unique training. You have a unique experience, a unique heart that means you can touch the lives of distressed people in a way that people who have never been in the cave can do. You have been uniquely qualified and trained by God to minister to somebody else. So don't just trust in God. Don't just turn to your friends. But touch somebody else who's in a cave. Touch somebody else who is distressed. Because true healing happens when we invest our lives not in our own sorrow, but in someone else. At the beginning of this sermon, I mentioned some people who had been there, like Sister Wilburn, or like Terry Reese. As you think about some of those folks I mentioned, they've been in that cave. They've dealt with the loss of loved ones. They've dealt with disease and illness. They've dealt with broken bodies and broken spirits. They've wept deep into the night in the darkness of their cave. But when I look at them, what I see is not that they've been there. What I see is that they're still here. Because the key to dealing with the cave is to keep looking out the opening. If I look in the depths of the cave, all I see is damp, dark, cold. But if I keep looking out the front of that cave, it doesn't mean my tears suddenly just dry up and go away. It doesn't mean I just suddenly stop missing the person that I'm missing. But hope is found when I keep looking out to what lies outside. And I see Miss Edith is here this morning. She's still looking out the front of the cave. And I see a lot of other hurting people this morning who have been in caves and maybe still feel like they're caves, but they're still here. I think of the times that people didn't come to worship with God's people because they had a headache. And yet there are people this morning who are here with broken hearts, who are here because they just kept looking out the opening of the cave. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn Encouragement? We offer an invitation all the time. And what can happen when you offer something all the time is it becomes routine. But what I want us to see is that an invitation, which is always open, we may offer it now, but you can respond to it any time. But an invitation is an opportunity to have hope when you're in your cave, to have confidence and celebration, even at those difficult moments in life. In other words, what we're trying to say when we offer an invitation is that God gives us hope where there is no hope and confidence where there is doubt. And that if I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God, and if I'll express that faith in repentance, confession, and baptism, Christ becomes a part of my life and hope becomes a part of my soul. That's why those people I mentioned are still here. That's why a David in the pit of his cave could say, I will praise you, Father, I adore you. Because he'd come to know what it means to have God in his life. I don't know what cave you're in this morning. I don't know if it's a cave of sin. I don't know if it's a cave of suffering. But we want to be the people to come to your cave. We just need to know you're there. We just need to know you're hurting. And that's part of what an invitation is. It's just a chance to say, family, I'm in the cave. And I need somebody to come to my cave. And know that when we get there to hug your neck, your Father's been there already. Because He's numbered every hair on your head. And has kept every tear that you've cried. It's that love that we offer as we stand and as we sing.